I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. A temporary road diet on Curry Ford Road has been compared to starvation. Some motorists drove straight through the bike-only lane, others cut through side streets rather than enduring the congestion. Cyclists, on the other hand, like the idea of a bike lane. So what does a road diet mean for motorists, cyclists and pedestrians? And what about the businesses along streets that get slimmed down? Drivers, what do you do when a cycle lane appears on what used to be a lane for cars? And cyclists, do you plan your commute around roads that do have bike lanes? Which are the best and worst roads to ride on, and are there other roads you think should go on a diet? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're joined by Chris Cairns, Division Manager of Transportation Engineering with the City of Orlando, and Amanda Day with Bike Walk Central Florida. Amanda Day begins the conversation by talking about safety for cyclists and pedestrians on Orlando streets.
When you talk about even the word safety, people always think, okay, so is it dangerous? Is it dangerous to walk here and bike here? In some places, yes, most definitely. Roads like 436 or Colonial Drive, in those areas, it is. It's very unsafe to walk or bike, and that's where you see a lot of the fatalities or injuries. However, that all being said, when you talk about safety improvements, what's happening here within the city of Orlando and really throughout the region is that the conditions are changing for people that are walking and biking and driving. And the road diet is just one of many examples.
Mm-hmm. We're getting a couple of comments here. Brandon writes in on our Twitter feed, "I don't mind sharing the roads with bikers. I'll respect them if they respect the rules of traffic. What I don't understand is why don't they use the trails? Isn't that why they were built?" Amanda Day, talk to us about mm-hmm. that. I mean, do the trails allow you to get around the city in the mode that you would like to?
At one day, yes. Right now, no. And that's something that actually the city of Orlando is doing, is working very hard of connecting the trails and the routes together so it is more seamless and that we can move people that are riding their bikes more on that trail network. Mm-hmm. But when you think about a trail, a lot of times automatically people assume that it's like the West Orange Trail and it's off to the side or off the road. Trails are really about connectivity and routes, and mm-hmm. that's safe routes from one point to another. So what you are going to be seeing a lot more of is infrastructure to be put in place for connecting people, connecting the trails, and connecting routes, too.
Mm-hmm. Matt writes in on Twitter as well, "Orlando is one of the most dangerous cities in the country to ride a bicycle. Anything we can do to change that is a benefit. The value of human life supersedes a few minutes of traffic frustration, in my opinion." Mm-hmm. Thanks for writing in with that, Matt. So some thoughts there, definitely some ideas. People are weighing in. I want to get a call in here. Let's go to Alan.
Thanks for taking my call. Here's my position on this is, I don't understand why we're expending all these funds to allow bicyclists in a roadway, regardless if it's a designated lane. We have sidewalks throughout Central Florida. I don't understand why we don't take that space and widen it for the cyclists, because this is not a situation where we have many commuters using their bicycles. This is more a situation of hobbyists who ride these multi-thousand-dollar bicycles in big packs that want space on the road, mm-hmm. that have no business on the road. And I think that's kind of the hidden theme here is this is more for these hobbyists that have maybe influence in the community and are, you know, striving to get some space on the road on the weekends or on the weekdays when they're riding in big groups. I don't see this massive amount of commuters using their bicycles to get to work, to and from.
Alan, I hear your point, but I wonder, I mean, I drive to work sometimes on Colonial Drive. I see people that I know are not riding $1,000 bikes, or if they are, they're very well disguised as, I don't know, like $50 or $100 bikes. And it looks to me like they're heading to work or back to work. So maybe it depends on where you drive, or maybe if you're a cyclist, you might say, well, if there were better options for commuting, then I would use those roads.
There's some other sidewalks. I mean, isn't that where are the sidewalks? Why can't we expand the sidewalks? Why do we have to put a pedestrian in the road where vehicles are driving? Because if a cyclist just simply misses a pedal, slips, hits a bump, and falls over, there's that risk that they're going to get run over by a vehicle. No mm-hmm. one can react that quickly if a bicyclist falls next to them. I just don't understand the concept of sharing the road with pedestrians. Pedestrians should be away from the road, away from vehicles, and we're putting them right dab in the middle of a situation where they can get hit. I mean, Florida.
Just to clarify, Alan, when you say pedestrians, do you mean people on bikes?
Yeah, I mean these are right. pedestrians either walking or you know using a bicycle. I mean, I look at them the same. Sometimes pedestrians use the roadway to walk for whatever reason. They cross the street
right.
in the middle of roadways, and then you have the bicyclists as well. This space should be only designated for vehicles and not for individuals either walking or cycling.
Alan, thank you so much for weighing in with those thoughts there. Some questions, I think, which we can throw to Chris Cairns. Clarify for us, Chris, this idea of sharing the road. I mean, legally, can a cyclist be on the road? Can a cyclist be taking up a lane?
Yes. By law, once they're in the road, they are a vehicle and subject to the same laws as vehicles. And it's a good point about sidewalks. If sidewalks are wider, they can be used better for some cyclists, but riding on the sidewalk is not always the safest. People come out in and out of driveways not looking for cyclists, so that's something to mix in there. But, yeah, they're definitely legal in both situations on most roadways.
Mm-hmm. And Amanda Day, just back to that point of what you are and aren't allowed to do on a bike, can you actually legally ride your bike on a sidewalk?
In the city of Orlando, you cannot. It is illegal. And kind of like what Chris was saying, though, that a person that rides the bike must adhere to the exact same laws as a person driving. There is no difference. And I think that the caller made a couple really good points of just bad behavior all the way around. So many times, especially in the weekends in large groups, you have large groups of cyclists out there on the roads, and they are, taking up an entire lane. There's just packs and packs of them that frustrates drivers because a driver is like, I need to get somewhere at a certain time. And there's this group of 50 to 100 cyclists, let's say, that's holding them up. On the other hand, too, a cyclist is just not, a one size fits all. Mm. There are people that bike to school with their kids. There's people that bike to work or just to run errands as well. It's a mode of transportation or a lifestyle for them.
And just on that note, I do actually see people, I'm pretty sure they're going to and from work on Colonial Drive, which,
right.
That's not necessarily the friendliest road to be cycling on, but there are people who are taking precautions. They've got the day glow vest, they've got the lights and everything, and you can tell that they're on their way somewhere. It doesn't look like it's a fun ride.
Right. And you'll see a little bit more and more people doing that as the culture evolves from just driving to including biking and people that walk. But I will say, though, too, when you're cycling on roads like Colonial or 436, for that matter, it is risky because you have cars or drivers that are going between 40 to almost 60 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of distraction that's out there that it is, it puts both in a precarious position too. So, as far as Bike Walk Central Florida, of riding on roads like that, it's not something that we would just sit there and advocate for. But there are certain people that certainly can ride on those roads and understand it and can navigate it. But it's not something that certainly would promote. It's scary,
right? Let's go back to Sally. Sally, I apologize for dropping your call before, but what's on your mind thinking about this conversation?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I really do think that this idea does pander to a minority, and here's why. I grew up and spent a lot of time overseas, and so traffic patterns, different change. And I just don't think that Orlando's problems are cyclist and pedestrian related in terms of how we focus. I think the bigger issue that the city of Orlando, and not just Orlando itself, but Orange County, that includes also unincorporated and Seminole, need to really address is the issue of public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
If you can reduce the number of cars on the road, you would increase safety, first of all, because it's almost impossible to get around anywhere in this city without a vehicle or if you have to take the bus, but the buses aren't really equivalent, and then the SunRail only has limited reach. And I think that's really the root of the problem. I don't see reduction of road size as a solution. I do know that the Orlando has a wonderful trail system.
Right.
I used to be a cyclist myself. I'm also a runner, and so I do take advantage of that, and you can really go quite a distance on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that some of the decisions and some of the, I guess, direction is really short-sighted, and I don't think that it's really solving the greater solution, which just is increased traffic. Orlando is growing really rapidly, and I mean, that's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing because the city and the county are not doing enough to solve the intrinsic traffic problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with this I-4 Ultimate, which is a cluster in my opinion, there's just really needs to be an increase in better and, you know, whatever.
Okay, well, Sally, I hear you loud and clear there. Some other issues at play there. Thanks for calling in. Chris Cairns, what about that notion? I mean, first of all, what's going to happen to the information once you've collected everything you've learnt from this one-month study of Curry Ford? How does that then translate into action? And is there anything like looking at what other potential mass transit options there might be?
Well, we're always trying to improve transit throughout the city and the region. So, yeah, those are good options, and people, that's not going to work for everybody, and there is the need for that last mile when you get off transit. Sometimes you still have a distance to go, like when you get off SunRail. So we need to make all options viable.
Mm-hmm.
So improving any bit of that is that is always in our mind as we move forward, and trying to build on this project specifically. We definitely want to learn where we've succeeded, where we failed, and so when we're looking at different corridors or different areas within the city, we don't make the same mistakes twice.
Mm-hmm. How did you actually go about gathering data? Like, did you interview drivers as they went through that stretch, or was it simply about looking at how fast the traffic was moving?
We did not interview any drivers. I didn't want to add to any safety concerns out there. So we have gotten feedback from people through multiple sources, social media, phone calls, many emails. We continue to document all the input that we get, which is both positive and negative.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a couple more comments in here via Twitter. David writes in, I just drove on this stretch of road, that's Curry Ford, yesterday around 5:45 p.m. There was a greater backlog of traffic due to the bike lane than there was previously, and I saw no bikes pass me while I sat there waiting. And then Jack writes in, some people just don't like to share or change. David and Jack, thank you for sharing your thoughts there. Just on that first comment, Chris Cairns, what about the cyclists? Did you take a tally of how many people were actually choosing to use that bike lane?
Sure. That is one of the things that we are tallying. And I want to emphasize that this is a safety project. It was not a bike project. So it was about bringing down speeds, making that this segment of Curry Ford feel like more of a place. And part of that can be people feeling comfortable enough to ride their bikes in the separated bike lane. And mm-hmm. there has been an increase. We don't know how much yet.
What about cars driving through that bike lane? Because I think I read something about some cars deciding to just ignore the green paint and those little plastic markers and just go for it.
Yes, there has been some of that. Some of it was inadvertent, I think, and some on purpose. And we asked our Orlando Police Department to help remind people how to behave. So they have been out there a couple times.
Mm-hmm. I want to get a couple more calls in here. We've got Tony on the line. Tony, what's on your mind?
I was just listening to the gentleman earlier on. I thought he was quite uncompromising when he was referring to cyclists as pedestrians. I think one of the things people have got to realize is it requires investment.
Right.
And if you're going to try and make the roads safer for cyclists, then you're going to have to invest. But one of the things that they could do, which would probably reduce serious injury and fatalities, is make headgear compulsory.
Hmm.
That to me makes perfect sense. I think Florida roads, Orlando in particular, are without doubt the most dangerous in America that I've ever experienced. I think the level of driving is appalling.
Hmm.
I agree with not having cyclists on the sidewalk. They are a danger. They are for pedestrians, unless you're going to widen them and you're going to have a strip which is available for them. But
right.
Then you need cyclists to observe a strict code. I mean, there is a responsibility on them as well.
Right, right, right. Hey, Tony, thanks for calling in. Just on that sidewalk note, we've got Mark calling in with a comment about sidewalk. Mark, what's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I was really responding to the call from Alan, and
it seemed to me he was coming from a driver's perspective.
Sure.
But I'm a cyclist, and I frequently ride on the sidewalks, even where there are bike lanes. And we were just talking about drivers riding in the green. I don't feel particularly safe. Mm. And I'm just wondering from a, you know, from a policy standpoint, it feels like we're in this battle for the road, whereas the sidewalk and kind of off-road areas, the stakes seem much lower. And yeah, it presents, you know, there are hazards there as well, mm-hmm. but there's not the volume of traffic. There's not the danger of getting hit. So I'm just wondering why, you know, really nationwide, worldwide, we're so focused on the streets versus figuring out an alternative that separates cyclists and drivers.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Amanda, what about that? Are we in a battle for the road? Is this some kind of gigantic sort of Lord of the Rings style Titanic struggle we're undergoing at the moment?
Most definitely. I love it. It is a battle for the road. It's a great analogy for it. But if you think about it, though, that we operate kind of in silos in our brain. So when we're driving, we think that we are, you know, superhuman. And if anyone gets in front of us or makes us late, there's this anger issue that everyone has.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're riding your bike, it is exactly the same way, that how dare that driver cuts me off, or even that person walks out in front of me.
Or these traffic lights don't apply to me.
Or these traffic lights don't apply to me. Why should I, you know, obey that law?
Hmm.
And if you're walking or even crossing the street, you believe you're superhuman as well, and that everyone should stop for you. So,
well, on that note, though, I mean, think about it. Like, if you're trying to cross the street and there's a traffic light sort of, I don't know, mm-hmm. 200 yards away, and you have the option of darting across the road, I mean, sometimes it's kind of like a comfort and convenience thing. I mean, you just can't make that extra, you know, half-mile schlep down to the crossing. It's not that some streets are necessarily designed for pedestrians, right?
Well, I would really say most of the streets aren't designed for people that walk. And if you think about the way that even how Central Florida has grown up, it has been all about the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the whole entire Southeast. So, yes, so you do see as a driver or even biking, a biker, and you see a person that's not going to go up to that crosswalk or up to the signal to use it, there's that level of frustration. And it's almost as if that person does get hit, they deserve it. And that is the kind of that mentality shift that we have here. And like what the caller said of that battle for the road, it's like, this is my space. How dare you stop me, make me late, or do anything to disturb me, regardless of that mode. So it is this whole mindset that needs to shift of not, it's them, it's their fault, it's us. And there should be places as far as of having a trail network or that separation, like the caller was talking about. There are cities, like, for example, from New York to Chicago to D.C., that are really looking at how to better separate people that do bike or walk and drivers, primarily because a lot of the danger
mm-hmm.
aspect, too.
Mm-hmm.
So made some great points.
Chris Cairns, are there some other roads that you're looking to slim down in the city? Are there some other places where commuters might be experiencing the same thing that they've seen on Curry Ford Road for the last month or so?
Well, there are roads that are being studied or considered for just different ways to make the road more part of the community. So I'm not going to say that we have a decided on a road diet. I should mention one. Robinson Street is a project that the Department of Transportation is working with us and other partners in Central Florida to change the typical road section in the downtown area
mm-hmm.
in several years from now.
Just want to get another comment in from Sarah. Highly disappointed in this morning's panel on road diets. Much better choices for those to represent all users of the road. Streets are for mobility and are public spaces. These bike lanes are for transportation. Who was on today to represent those riders? Well, I hear your point, Sarah, but I feel like we do have some representation from Amanda Day here with Bike Walk Central Florida, but thanks for chiming in. What about that, Amanda? Do you feel like that cyclists are getting enough of a say in, you know, just the idea of repurposing some of those roads for their use as well as motorists?
No, I will say they don't. And that's partly, too, of needing to show up more from the city and the county meetings and planning and being more part of that process. That, you know, there needs to be better representation of people that ride their bikes. And I would even say, too, with people that walk and the pedestrians, too, that it's very much so underrepresented. with all that being said, slowly, and it's very slow, a culture shift is happening in which within the cities and counties, and, you know, Chris is a great example, too, of working with him, of asking the question of, you know, are we doing enough or what can we do differently to improve the connectivity and access for people that are walking and biking? And the pilot project there on Curry Ford is just one of many examples.
Mm-hmm. Chris, in the last 30 seconds or so, what's next for this? What do you do with that data now you've collated it?
Well, similar to as I mentioned before, we're going to see what has worked, what has not, and hopefully apply some of the positive parts to future segments. And we'll continue to look at ways to work with Orange County and other partners in the region to basically take a bigger approach to all these projects.
Well, Chris Cairns is Division Manager of Transportation Air and Engineering with the City of Orlando. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Amanda Day with Bike Walk Central Florida, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Up next, getting ready for the hurricane season while still tallying the impact of Irma. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane season starts in less than a month, but many communities across Florida are still fixing up damage from last September when Irma rolled through the state. Alan Harris is the emergency manager for Seminole County. Alan, welcome back to Intersection.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I can't believe it's already this time again.
Certainly is. So are you ready for hurricane season?
Well, you know, we are doing everything that we can to get prepared. We have been doing a lot of training, training staff to be shelter workers. Mm-hmm. We've been revisiting all of our emergency plans, visiting each one of the shelters. We took a lot of the after action items from our community members as well as the first responders and the secondary responders. Those are the librarians, the parks folks, everybody works in the county. So we had only 14 employees that didn't work during Hurricane Irma, and that was because of medical issues. All the rest of the employees did something. So we took their after action comments and have been improving in preparation for the hurricane season.
So the after action comments are just like, what can we do better next time?
Sure. Everything from improving generator support at the shelters to some equipment that we may need at some of the shelters for the disabled, to how we do recovery, better ways of doing recovery. And we've also been looking at some mitigation plans. So we've strengthened three of our shelters. We've done some mitigation with some flooding. Elevated a home using some Small Business Administration dollars. So there's been a lot of mitigation and also a lot of planning as this hurricane season comes up.
I want to get into some of those details in a bit, but first, just back to the training. I was reading that you did about 17 trainings for your staff before last hurricane season. Have you had to ramp that up this year?
We did, and we've already completed 8 shelter trainings. Some of the individuals wanted refresher and then new employees that came in. So 17 did a lot of employees last year, but we made those available again this year. We have 2 more coming up in a couple weeks, and we'll continue to do that until the hurricane hits us. So we have at least 2 each month until, you know, a hurricane hits us, and then we'll lessons learned and revamp our training. The training is slightly different than last year. We enhanced it. We added some crisis counseling, some stress management things in there for the customers that are the residents of the shelter, and then some first aid. Even though each of one of our shelters has an ambulance, not all shelters in every county has that, but in Seminole, all of our shelters have an ambulance. But we also want our staff trained for basic first aid so they can render assistance if the ambulance crew happens to be busy.
With the shelters last Hurricane Irma, you had 7 open and then a couple on standby. And I think you had to actually use all of those shelters, right?
Yeah, we ended up using all 9.
Do you think you have enough, or do you need to think about more shelters for the next hurricane season?
So we have 18 shelters on the list. Shelters are in schools. Schools were not designed for residential living. So we try to pick the best of the schools first, and then we have the other ones there that are backups. And in some cases, those may not have full generator support. They may not have generators going to certain areas where we want them to go. So they can be used, but they're not optimal. We would prefer to use the top ones. So that's why we open them in a tiered approach. Also, we just don't have a lot of staff. I mean, eventually staff runs out. So once that happens, then we have to look to volunteers. And unfortunately, the volunteer pool for sheltering, and even the American Red Cross agrees, they only have three or four shelter volunteers that can show up in Seminole County. So we've been doing recruiting, but a lot of people evacuate. So they don't want to volunteer during the storm. They don't mind volunteering afterwards. They don't mind volunteering before. But during the hurricane, when all the people are in the shelter, they don't normally want to volunteer.
So how do you go about recruiting volunteers? Like, is there a certain number of volunteers you're looking to recruit? And how do you get them? How do you train them?
I'm so glad you asked me that question. I wish that I had actually written that down for you to ask me. We have a program called Adopt a Shelter. So years ago, I was driving down the road and I saw this Adopt a Road sign. And I'm like, why don't we do that in emergency shelters? So some of our shelters are adopted shelters. So faith-based organizations, nonprofits have adopted a specific shelter. So in that case, then they provide supplemental support to the county. That supplemental support allows the county employees to go much, much further, and they can still manage the shelter at multiple schools. But now we have more volunteers to help with registration, help with dormitory management, help with information flow and stuff like that inside of the shelter, because those are the big things. People want to register. They want to, you know, get in safely. They want their place wherever they're going to sleep. And they want some food. And that's what we provide. It's a very basic service. It's not a cruise ship. It is a lifeboat.
How does Irma fit into your experience of the storms you've seen? Like, how bad was that for you?
So Hurricane Irma was barely a Category 1. So it was forecast to be a Category 3 when it got here, and it did not make it, thank God. The land in Florida somehow disrupted it. The storm was not as strong as that we thought it was, so it broke apart much, much faster. So we did get hurricane-force winds in Seminole County, but nothing over Category 2, Category 1, sustained, but at the very low spectrum of Category 1. So how does that compare? That's basically smaller than Hurricane Charley in 2004. So it was not as bad as 2004 Hurricane Charley. The reason for the long response and recovery time is Charley went very, very fast, and it went diagonal. Hurricane Irma, every county in the state of Florida in the Eastern Standard Time was activated. It doesn't happen that often. The last time it happened was way, way back in when the whole entire state had 4 million people. There's 4 million people in Miami-Dade, Fort Lauderdale area. So it was a long, long time ago. I forget the year, but it basically did almost the exact same track. But it was so long ago that, I mean, not even real good records are kept of it.
So for Seminole County, the big story was really the flooding, right? That lasted a long time. I mean, those, you know, the St. John's River took a long time to go down. Those lakes took a long time to go down. What was the impact of that flooding?
Sure. An inland county suffers almost everything that a coastal county does except for the storm surge. So that one, if you get through that in an external coastal county, pretty much you have the same exact damage. So if it's low tide and the hurricane comes in, you are dealing with the same thing that we are dealing with as an internal county. So the big things in internal county, wind damage, and we see a lot of blue roofs still, and that's because of the wind damage, flooding, which you said. And our flooding lasted a long time because we did not only have Hurricane Irma, we also had a tropical event shortly after. And people don't even remember that because it rained for a little while, there was no name to it, and then it went away. The tributaries filled up again, went into the St. John's River, and St. John's River again expanded. So we were flooding from September the 11th to just right at December the 11th. That's how long the western portion and the northern portion of Seminole County flooded. If you were in the center portion of Seminole County, if you were in Orlando or anywhere else driving around, you wouldn't have seen any flooding whatsoever. But if you've gone over the 417 bridge, if you've gone over I-4, you would have automatically have clearly seen the flooding that was taking place. And of course, if you're a resident along the St. John's River or a neighborhood close to the St. John's River, you also experienced flooding.
Right. That was like weeks and weeks of misery for those folks, right?
Absolutely.
They were still kayaking around on those flooded roads long after the storm had passed.
Right. A lot of some people got rental RVs and they stayed at the edge of their neighborhood. Some people went to hotels. They stayed in hotels for months.
It was an expensive storm. I think more than $300 million in damage for Seminole County. How big a hit is that, and what does that mean for the emergency management system? Like, do you then have to dip into coffers elsewhere to have enough in reserve for the next storm that rolls through?
Right. So right now we're floating Hurricane Matthew and Hurricane Irma. So we had already quite a bit out of the reserves for Hurricane Matthew, and then Hurricane Irma was a much more severe storm than Hurricane Matthew. Hurricane Matthew brushed us. Still a lot of damage, but just brushed us. Hurricane Irma, a lot more damage. So we do have to dip into reserves. We have to look at that as we go into budget, and we're in budget right now as we start to plan the budget for next year. The great thing about this particular storm was we were federally declared, and that the first 30 days it was 100% reimbursement, which it happens in large storms, Harvey, Irma, Sandy, Katrina. So the first 30 days, the federal government will get those tax dollars that we've given to the federal government back into our community for this particular disaster. So that's good. Those monies are coming back to us
to
rebuild.
How long does that
that's
take?
The problem is it could be years. It took us, I'm going to say, like 6, maybe 7 years for us to finally close out Charlie, Francis, and Jean 2004. Tropical Storm Fay, which was 2008, closed a little bit faster, and that's just because it was a tropical storm. It didn't pack the wall up that Irma did with winds. It definitely did a lot more flood damage because it just sat on us. So it could be 3-4 years. So we're preparing for that, especially if we get hit by another one. That means we're also dipping again into the coffers, the reserves, and trying to recuperate that.
Alan Harris, you mentioned the fact that this storm was unusual in that it affected a lot of counties. Pretty much all of Florida was affected. Seminole County, you know, you're a smaller county. How do you kind of fight for attention, whether it's for federal funding, for state funding, in amongst other more badly hit counties?
Well, I think every other emergency manager would agree. I'm quite boisterous, so I do fight for my county, Seminole County. I love Seminole County, and I know other emergency managers are doing the same thing. It is more challenging for a smaller county. We always try to stress that there was a large need, and we can do that by a couple of things. So we did good damage assessment. We did good photography so FEMA could see visually a picture of what was going on. We gave them cost estimates very, very quickly, faster than most of the counties in the state of Florida. And we try to do that so that we get reimbursed or at least declared as quickly as possible so that we can get reimbursed. You know, it's much, much better to know that we are going to get assistance. At least that helps a little bit than to be in that limbo. And we just try to paint a picture. I mean, we have almost 500,000 people. So we have 500,000 people in our community, even though we're the third smallest.
Right.
We're also the third most densely populated. So we need to paint that picture. And I have to paint that picture to them as well. We did get all the assistance that we needed from the state of Florida, from FEMA. It was, you know, it was a little time, but that's not to say that, you know, their hands were full. They were just dealing with, they had just got done with Harvey. All the resources were in Harvey. They couldn't pull the resources out of Harvey because that would have been a real bad black eye for them in Texas.
Yeah.
If FEMA's pulling out. So they pulled what they could to get to us. But it was very interesting. The people that were wearing FEMA shirts weren't necessarily FEMA employees.
Huh.
They could have worked for Health and Human Services. They could have worked for the FBI and things like that. They were reassigned to FEMA to help in Irma in some cases.
Let me just switch gears for a moment, Alan Harris. What's in your personal hurricane preparation kit, and have you had time to get that set up for the storm season yet?
Sure. And, you know, we used to say, have a plan, get a kit, stay informed. That used to be the phrasing, you know, have a plan, know where you're going to go, things like that, get a kit, some disaster supplies, canned food, waters and things like that, and then stay informed. Listen to the local radio station. We broadcast directly through WMFE here whenever there's a hurricane. So we talk to you a lot during the storm. So continue to listen to that as well as our alerting software. But now we're adding another note, and that is check your insurance. get insurance, check your insurance. A lot of people had insurance and their insurance did not cover flooding, or their insurance did not cover whatever, a sinkhole, or get that extra coverage. Even if you don't live in a flood zone, people were flooding and they didn't live in a flood zone. It could have been because of a backup in the storm system. It could be whatever. And unfortunately, those people were left out. The insurance company came. They said, no, you were flooded. You had some wind damage. We'll fix that. But the flood damage, we don't cover that. So if you don't live in a flood zone, flood insurance is extremely easy to get. So that's what I've done this year. I don't live in a flood zone. I specifically bought my house. I'm an emergency manager. I bought my house out of the flood zone for a purpose. But I will tell you, and I'll admit to everyone that's listening today, I did not have flood insurance. I have flood insurance today.
Alan Harris, Emergency Manager with Seminole County, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, John Corbell, one of our Tiny Desk Concert local favorites, joins us in the studio. Intersection's back in a minute. You, the classroom beauty, me, a tortured fool. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. She was Judas's silver, 30 pieces of pain, caught with coin of desire. You're listening to John Corbell performing a song called Judas's Silver. It was recorded at WMFE's Zippo Throwdown at the Timucua Arts Foundation in Orlando last week. Corbell was one of the top local favourites of the NPR Music Tiny Desk concert, as voted by you in April. He has an EP out called Earthlight, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us, John.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thank you, Matthew.
So talk to me about your song, Judas's Silver. You introduced it at the live event as a song about, quote, religious cheating. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of a song where I took some imagery that, you know, everybody's familiar with in terms of a turncoat. But I put it in the context of somebody that's conflicted about cheating on their spouse, you know, using some images that people can relate to, but also kind of the old country western idea of a cheating song. Her eyes are
so precious like jewels. Now, you've performed at Timucua before. What does it mean for a musician like yourself to have access to a venue like the Timucua Arts Foundation?
Well, for anyone that's familiar with the White House, as they call it over there, it's such an intimate setting, first off. You have an audience that's right there up close and personal.
It's literally Benoit's living room.
It's his living room, is his den and his rehearsal hall for his – he does his own practicing. Benoit Glaser was the music director for many years of La Nuba at Disney. And Cirque du Soleil. And he has developed this venue over a long number of years. And it's just a real treasure for our area. And I was lucky enough to perform there for a full concert a while back. And I hope to do it again. It's just such a great venue.
So tell me about the song Sing.
Again, that was one that kind of came together both as a musical challenge in terms of the way the progression is structured and everything, and also to come up with the idea of expressing yourself beyond what you think your capabilities are and, you know, reaching for something stronger and greater. The hook is sing like you're already there. You know, and it's also, I think, a little bit of a self-pep talk for me to want to expand what I'm doing and grow as an artist.
Speaking of singing, you really throw yourself into the vocal side of your performance. You clearly get a lot of enjoyment out of performing. Who inspires you? Like, where do you draw your your sense of performance from as far as other artists?
I guess to look back over the years, my influences early on included the late, great Al Jarreau, who I saw in his last Orlando performance at the Plaza Live a couple years ago. He was a big inspiration to me, as well as Michael Franks is a big influence. There are tons of influences. I really see Sting as an influence, especially when he began his solo career, you know, going beyond what he did with the Police. More recently, I listened to a lot of Kurt Elling, who was a wonderful jazz singer, and his writing is really fascinating to me as well. They don't talk about his songwriting as much because he's such an amazing jazz interpreter, but I enjoy all of his stuff. As far as vocally, though, you know, I think that a lot of what I do as a singer comes from an experience of having sung with a big eight-piece horn band years ago up in the Philadelphia area where I'm originally from. Singing with three horn players and a whole big rhythm section, you've got to be able to power beyond that. I think for better or worse, that's where a lot of my vocal firepower comes from, is having to have competed with that lineup.
Tell me about the EP. You've been hard at work promoting it, and you're getting ready to go on a tour, but you recorded this up in Nashville, and Nashville, of course, is more associated with country music, but you managed to find some artists there to take part in the recording. How did that all turn out?
Yes, well, it's really tremendously fortunate. First off, I've had an association with a really great producer in Nashville, Art Ward, his company Century Music Group. I've been doing projects with him for a number of years. And when we came up with the plan to do the Earthlight EP, first off, we wanted to tap into the more bossa nova and Latin and that aspect of my writing. And so the tunes that we selected to record reflect that. And then we were fortunate also in that we were able to get on the session a bunch of guys that routinely played together. They were already very familiar with one another from this thing called the Nashville Jazz Workshop. Most folks, as you said, associate Nashville with country music, as well they should. But the guys that do that studio work in Nashville are all really amazing musicians. And for the Earthlight session, we were able to get, for instance, Marcus Finney on drums, who was on the Grammy-winning album with Taj Mahal and Keb Mo this year, and also did the tour with them. We had Joe Davidian on piano, who was teaching at Belmont University at the time, but he's in New York now, performing at in the jazz world in New York. And Chris West on saxophone, and really a tremendous lineup. So we were really fortunate. And these guys, having played together quite a bit, had, you know, a tremendous chemistry. They fed off of each other really well. And that, I think, comes through on the record.
What's the story behind your track, Last Year of Innocence?
It has a pretty important personal meaning to me, because the idea behind it came from a book, from a memoir that my older brother wrote like I said, it's a memoir of his eighth grade year in the little Catholic school that we went to in outside of Philadelphia there. And in the book, he relates a lot about this sort of little crush that he had on a girl in his eighth grade year. And when you're a kid and you have an older brother like that, you never really think of him as being this romantic, you know. But it came through in the book, and I was really struck by it. So I extracted different things from the book and incorporated it into the song. And then since we were already in the planning stages of this bossa nova project that Earthlight turned into, it really was a natural fit to write the song in that vein, with that kind of rhythm going.
Stupid, stupid, stupid is how I often feel.
So where can people hear you perform next?
We have a monthly jazz show, a jazz jam, that we've been putting on in Orlando for many years. Yvonne Coleman in town here is the one behind it. And it's going to be this Monday at Dexter's in Windermere. And it's myself and a number of really tremendous jazz players here in Orlando. Joseph Giovanni is the musical director, and a lot of terrific guests that get to sit in, and I'm just one of them. And always for a good cause. We have a different charity every time we do it.
Well, John Corbell has an EP out called Earthlight. He was one of the top local favorites of the NPR Music Tiny Desk concert, as voted by you. You can find a link with more details about his website on WMFE.org. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can learn more and watch the Tiny Desk entries at WMFE.org/Tiny Desk, and we'll feature the other local favourites on Intersection as well. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. If you appreciate the in-depth news and interviews you hear on Intersection and other local programs on 90.7, consider a gift of support in any amount. You can make a contribution during our Silent Pledge Drive by calling 1-800-785-2020. You can also click on over to our website, wmfe.org/support. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Danielle Pryor answered the phones. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening. Our lives will be so different.